This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Lynn McMullen, National Campaign Director for the Peace Alliance, a nonpartisan citizen action organization advocating for legislation that supports a culture of peace. Lynn has been a political activist and fundraiser working on national hunger and poverty legislation for over 20 years. She also has co-founded a new nonprofit and launched an initiative in South Africa to bring microfinance to orphans and vulnerable youth. In addition, she serves on the Grameen Foundation Board of Directors and does consulting with the Center for Nonviolent Communication and Marshall Rosenberg. Lynn McMullen is here today to tell us about the work of the Peace Alliance to establish a United States Department of Peace. Welcome, Lynn.
Well, thanks.
What is your definition of peace?
Wow, that's a great question to start with. I would just say that it's not just a cessation of violence. It's not just the ending of violence, but actually a culture of peace, let's start with that, would be a culture in which peace-building and peace-making skills were pervasive everywhere in the culture. So youth are understanding it, adults are understanding it, and I think in many ways we have not caught up with the social studies, and I mean by that the studies of us as social creatures, about how to reduce violence in violent situations, how to de-escalate conflict when it is in our families, our neighborhoods, our community, or in international situations. So for me, peace is really an active state, a state in which people are proactively finding ways to meet everyone's needs peacefully.
Why was the Peace Alliance formed, and what is your history?
Started off, there was sort of two organizations kind of came together in the Peace Alliance. One was Marianne Williamson founded something she called the Global Renaissance Alliance, and its purpose was to bring the basic core common spiritual principles of all religions to bear in politics. And so we had people from kind of all sides of the religious spectrum participating in various types of political campaigns. But primarily, the Department of Peace was one of our primary initiatives. And during that time, Dennis Kucinich, as you may know, introduced this legislation while he was running, or just before he began running for president. And at the end of his presidential campaign, several of his staff just really wanted to work on the Department of Peace campaign. So all of us formed one organization, really an umbrella, and it's called the Peace Alliance.
To what extent has the idea of a Department of Peace been looked at previously in American history?
Well, there's over 80 times, I think it's 85 times, that someone introduced legislation to create a Department of Peace, going all the way back to the time of George Washington. It was being discussed by Benjamin Rush, one of the members that signed the Declaration of Independence, and Benjamin Banneker. And the two of them took this idea to George Washington, really pushing it on the idea if we were going to be a new country for a new way of thinking and a new way of living, a Department of Peace would only make sense because the Department of War was way too violent solution for them over time. So that's, I would say, the history has been that it's been introduced lots of times. There has not been a sustained groundswell of support from the citizens to actually make this law. That's how I see it. I just don't think that the attention from enough citizens for a long enough period of time has built enough popularity behind the concept to make it happen.
Could you go into details about the goals of the Peace Alliance?
The goal of the Peace Alliance at this moment is primarily, our primary goal is to pass Department of Peace legislation. And we do some things that are less direct about that. For example, we just finished completing a white paper on violence and violence prevention. And this white paper was a research project that was done by the Peace Alliance Foundation. So on the one hand, you could say it's not directly related to this legislation, but it is an educational document that we can use to help people understand, really, the extent to which we are a violent society and the extent to which we can do something to address that. In other words, what programs do we currently have that can show that they're reducing the likelihood of violence in their communities?
What would be the function of a Department of Peace? What specific projects would they be in charge of?
I like to talk about the bill in sort of three ways, and those are the overarching department, the domestic, meaning what's happening in the United States, and what's happening internationally. So I'll start with the overarching. First of all, there would be a Secretary of Peace. This means that every time the president sits down with the cabinet, there's someone whose job it is to offer peaceful alternatives to any of the social problems and international problems the president faces. For example, if we're looking at Iran right now, as a real problem, but who is being paid to pull together the best thinking in the country on how we could peacefully meet our needs in relation to the threat of Iran? And this is one of the first things that would happen with the Department of Peace, is that we would have a Secretary of Peace whose job it is and whose staff would assist in creating nonviolent solutions to all the social problems. Now, secondly, and probably the biggest chunk of the money would actually be spent on violence reduction programs that are currently active already in the United States and build on those successes. This bill was very first introduced July 11th of 2001, 2 months before 9/11. And so people are often surprised to hear that because they think that the legislation for a Department of Peace is directly related to the war that we're fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq. But it isn't. Dennis Kucinich's idea behind it was really to invest more money to reduce violence in the U.S. What do I mean by that? Well, we have youth homicide rates that are 10 times the rate of other industrialized nations. That's pretty scary. Or the WHO recently reported that the cost of interpersonal violence, not including any war-related costs, was $300 billion a year for the U.S. So we are much more violent than other industrialized nations, and at the same time, another example might be the number of gangs that we have. We have 31,000 gangs operating in the United States in over 4,800 cities and towns. So if you look at all of that together, are there any solutions? And we have little tiny programs that are showing how you can work with young students, say, age 8 or 9, to reduce the likelihood that they will join gangs. There's other ways that we can reduce violence by reducing the recidivism rates of our prisons. But any of the social programs that reduce the recidivism rates are being cut from the federal and the state budgets because people have not been really aware of the extent to which they are saving us money. So the second piece on the domestic side would be to research and disseminate what I call promising practices. I don't like to use the word best practice. It implies that everything's done instead of that we're developing methods for intervening in cases of violence. And so it would really be funding programs like battered women's shelters and programs for intervention for families with violent histories. These are the kinds of things that we can begin to do. One of the things is like the whole issue of gang prevention. One youth in prison, like under the age of 18, runs between $80,000 to $100,000 a year as the taxpayers. So if we spend this kind of money on putting youth in prison, and if they're in prison for 3 years, the likelihood is quite high that they will be in and out of prison their whole lives. And that means a multiple million-dollar ticket for the American taxpayer. Surely there's got to be another way. And that's really what the Department of Peace is about, is researching and articulating and disseminating promising practice and investing in expanding and replicating the most effective programs in reducing various aspects of domestic violence in the homes. Violence amongst police departments are the number one cause of police department death and injury in the city of Detroit, for example, is breaking up domestic violence dispute. This is also the case for firefighters. Many cases in many cities and towns, there's such a glut of domestic violence calls that the police departments can't meet it all and send emergency firemen out to break up domestic violence disputes. And most of them have little or no training on how to effectively do that and not get injured or killed. This is one of the main reasons why many of the cities across this country, we're up to 16 cities, have endorsed the Department of Peace as a core idea. So that's the domestic piece, and then I'll just say something quick for the international side. I think a lot of Americans are very discouraged and disheartened by the way that our foreign policy has been falling out. What I mean by that is, so many countries are angry with us, so many people criticize us. Are there ways we could be building a better foreign policy? If the goal of foreign policy is to have the rest of the world really like your country and actively participate in cooperation with your country, we'd have to say that there's a lot to be desired in the foreign policy right now. And I think that we have neglected, there's sort of three parts of foreign policy in my mind, and maybe this is a little simplistic, but there's defense, which we're very big on, but there's also diplomacy, and development. In other words, if we help other countries develop their social infrastructure, their physical infrastructure, their health infrastructure, development can go a long way toward building goodwill in our foreign policy. And we have cut our development budget to the bone. Less than 0.5% of the total budget is being spent on actual development work. And then diplomacy, we spend less than 2% of our budget on diplomacy. And so basically what the Department of Peace would do is it is not anti-war and it is not anti-defense. It is about developing our capacity to implement and discover and design nonviolent solutions to the world's conflicts.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Lynn McMullen, National Campaign Director for the Peace Alliance. Our topic is the work of the Peace Alliance to establish a United States Department of Peace. What relation would a Department of Peace have to other departments, such as the Department of Defense and the Department of State?
Well, first of all, the Department of State would continue to have its authority. The Department of Peace would not interfere with current lines of authority with the President or the State Department. What it would do is offer alternatives. For instance, the Department of Peace would be called in to show 5 ways we might be able to get out of Iraq with minimum deaths. That would be one example. Another example would be that if there is, say, violence going on in a given prison, then the Department of Peace could be involved in that. In the conflict between agencies, the Department of Peace could provide mediation services. So some of the conflict that's been going on between the NSA and the CIA and the FBI could actually bring them together and use some of the methodologies in how to deconstruct conflict and find solutions that everybody's needs get met. This is a methodology that's been developing over the last, I'd say, 40 years. And there are now over 300 universities in the United States where you can get a degree in some aspect of peacekeeping, peace studies, peace building. And so why are so many universities doing this? Because we're beginning to understand ourselves better. Maybe you can even look in your own life. We're all getting better at how to deconstruct conflict in our own families. How to listen when people are upset with you or when you're upset with them, how to listen to yourself and to them with more compassion. These kinds of skills would be a huge part of it, and I think that part of what the Department of Peace has to offer the rest of the government is mediation services and problem solving. And so those are some of the ways that I think the Department of Peace would relate. It would not be a dominant institution in the sense that it would overturn any of the State Department's initiatives, but more advise the State Department how to make these initiatives have a less long-term costly effect.
Could you say more about the relation of a Department of Peace to the U.S. military?
Well, one thing I just want to say is that many of our soldiers end up going into, say, Baghdad, and have very little training about the culture of the countries that they're working in. One of my colleagues was speaking to somebody at a car rental counter. He was about ready to leave for Iraq. She said to him, have you had any training in how to understand the cultural differences between our countries so you don't accidentally insult people? He just looked at her with a blank stare. We feel very strongly that particularly since so many times now the U.S. military is being used in a peacekeeping role like we're supposedly having right now in Afghanistan and Iraq, but are not really trained in any of the deconstruction methodologies that peacemakers and peace builders know. So one of the things the Department of Peace would do is provide training and resources for additional training to military personnel about how to operate in a peacekeeping environment. If you're a surgeon, you're going to see the world through a surgeon's eyes, and your advice will be mainly surgical. And if you're a nutritionist, you see the world in a very different way. And we sort of see this as similar to how the Department of Defense works and how the Department of Peace works. It's just a different strategy, and we want to have this strategy developed to the extent to which the military strategy is developed so we can have a more balanced approach to any of the conflict happening in the world.
Could you now talk about your strategy to bring about a Department of Peace?
The main strategy, you know, as the campaign coordinator is what I call grassroots engagement. In other words, if we pass this legislation, let's say we could wave a magic wand and pass the legislation, it wouldn't necessarily get us the department we want, particularly in the first round. And most good government takes time. It takes time for people to really get seriously engaged, and it takes time for people to assess how well it's working, to tighten the legislative language to ensure that the money is being spent in the ways that match the values and goals of the American public. So what do I do by that? I mean, I'm spending most of my time talking on the phone to volunteer networks around the country. We have over 280, you might say, local groups that are organizing the campaign at the local level, and we're doing it by congressional district. So, for example, if someone who's listening wanted to get involved in the campaign, they would go to our website, which you could go in as a Google search, Department of Peace, or you could go to The Peace Alliance, thepeacealliance.org. Be sure you put the "the" in there or you'll end up in an organization in the UK. So we have this website, and then there's a map on there, and you can click on the map and then click on your state. And when you're sitting there looking at your state, by each congressional district, we have team leaders in 280 of the 435 that exist. There's also state coordinators. So you can click on a neighboring district where there's someone there. There's a name, and we have an email system, so you don't know their email, but we forward it basically to the people involved, and then they can respond to you. And this way, we're hooking up people who are interested in the legislation all over the country, and over half of the country, we have active chapters working on the campaign, meeting with their members of Congress. And some of the simple activities that they're doing are writing letters to the editor for their local newspapers, meeting with their members of Congress in Washington, D.C., in our conference. We have one coming up the first weekend of February. In addition to that, we have volunteers who actually meet with the district staff in the local offices during the year. We take in people from the prisons, from the battered women shelters, to actually brief the congressional staff on the extent to which violence is happening in this country and the solutions that actually already exist were we to expand them to fit the need. So I think that kind of tells you a little bit about how the campaign works.
Where does the process currently stand in terms of the bill going through both the House and the Senate? And also perhaps you could go into more detail about exactly what's proposed in the bills right now.
Okay. Well, there's, as you said, there's two bills. They're almost identical. The House bill is House 3760 and the Senate bill is 1756. This is just for people who like to know those numbers and want to look up the legislation. On the website, thepeacealliance.org, you can actually download the whole bill. It's about 15 pages. And it's both bills are almost identical. They're almost identical. So anyway, so you can go ahead and look at the legislation there. The legislation that we're working on is an authorizing bill. And what I mean by that is it's a legal framework. It does not actually spell out where the money will be spent. That's something that happens in the appropriating bill. And generally in Congress, you know, over the years I've learned that you generally pass the authorizing bill first and then the appropriating bill after. And so that's kind of the status that we're in. We have 75 members in the House that are currently endorsing this bill, and that's 75 out of 435. So basically a sixth of the House of Representatives supports this. On the Senate side, we have 2 out of 100. So we have a long way to go. That's just obviously true. But I would say that our biggest challenge is actually Republicans. We actually do believe that the Republicans would want this legislation, and we certainly have a number of them that are very interested in the legislation, but they're very distrustful about what does it really mean for the military, what does it really mean for the police. So we're kind of working out some of the details. I don't believe that the bill will be able to fully pass until we can actually describe where all the money will go. But the main issues here are really building bridges across the political divide. You know, I like to tell people, I think political discourse in America right now is bankrupt, meaning that it's more about teams and telling people they're wrong than it is about gathering around the problems that we consider most urgent and the solutions we can agree upon. Let's just take a simple thing. I know about a program in San Diego that's active all over this nation, reducing the likelihood that children join gangs. And they go in and work with kids as young as 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. And they do pre- and post-testing on whether the kids think gangs are neat and cool. And they can reduce the amount of respect and sort of interest that kids have in gangs long before they ever hit gang-joining ages. So this kind of program runs $75 per child. Now, if we save one kid, that's going to run $80,000 a year from ending up in prison. So it's financially cheaper not to mention sort of the human and social cost of all of the violence of our youth and the death rate of our youth. So it's we look at it as really an education campaign in many ways, in spite of the fact that the Democrats now have both houses. Our biggest goal this year is still actively engaging the Republicans in the design of the ultimate department we will have, so that it's something that people begin to understand. It's not about, instead of the war, we're going to do this. This is about developing a capacity we've let lie dormant. People sometimes say to me, "You're such a dreamer. Human beings are violent." I don't have any misunderstanding about the violent streak in a human being. You just have to read a little bit of history and you can see it. The question is, do we have a compassionate streak? And I think we do. And have we ever developed our capacities in our compassionate areas? So one of the things that I'm most eager to do, frankly, Diane, is implement the program for the school kids. Teach children everywhere how to de-escalate bullying on a playground. Right now, bullying is happening on the majority of children's playgrounds all over this country, and the likelihood that those kids will eventually act out is very high, whether it be through the suicide rate, which is climbing everywhere, or the homicide rate, as I said earlier, which is more than 10 times of other industrialized countries. About 1 in 3 high school students right now say they've been in a physical fight in the past year. So I think these kinds of issues can directly be addressed, and that the likelihood that we would be able to have a more peaceful society when children grow up understanding how to create more peace is much higher. And I just cannot stop without saying that domestic violence is the biggest cause of injury to women in this country. 22% of the women of the United States are physically assaulted by intimate partners in their lifetime. 22%, that's more than one in five. So when you look at that kind of a statistic, you have to ask yourself, what are we doing wrong, or what are we forgetting? And I don't think we're actually teaching our children or ourselves the necessary skills to get out of situations when violence occurs and to provide services to people in those situations. I live in Washington State, as you know, Diane, and in our state in 2005, we gave away 3,800, just think of that number, 3,800 bed nights, a little bit more than that, but about that, 3,800 bed nights to battered women and their children. But we turned away 32,000 women and children in an emergency battering situation because we had no place to put them. So I think at some level we have to begin to confront the level of violence in our society and our lack of an ability to respond to it well. And once we begin to see that, then we can start to look at how much we could save if we reduced the overall cost of prison and violence.
What do you see happening in Congress during the next year in regard to establishing a Department of Peace? Do you see progress?
Well, it's definitely progress. I mean, just in the last year, 2005, in January of 2005, which is a little, almost 2 years now, we had 60 active groups in the country, and now, as I mentioned, we have 280. And if, let's say, even 50 of, or half of them are not active, we still have tripled the size of our volunteer base in the last year and 9 months. So we actually anticipate a growing grassroots movement around the country. We expect by the end of 2007 to have every single congressional district in the country, at least a small group of people active in every state, to be able to begin. We expect this to be the year that we break into Republican ranks and find Republican leadership who are willing to make this the bipartisan initiative we intend for it to be. We don't want to pass it, even if we could, with all Democrats. We actually want to pass it with the collaboration of all perspectives on the political spectrum. So those are some of our main goals. We're having this conference. About 600 people will be coming from all over the country in Washington, D.C. the first week of February. And then we're working to get more into some of the areas we have the least amount of volunteers. And I'm just thinking of, say, Alaska. We have a small amount of volunteers now in Pennsylvania. Tennessee and Kentucky are just sort of starting. So some of those areas we intend to do more growth work in this year. As I said, this is really about engaging the American public. We're trying to actually have people who can see the vision of this bill stand up and speak on its behalf. And we don't want to just have some special interest make it happen, because it won't actually bring the level of cultural change that a campaign that involves citizens can do.
What other groups are actively supporting a Department of Peace?
Well, we have on the website, on the left-hand column of the front page, is a long list of endorsers, but I'll just name a couple that you probably know. Amnesty International endorses this bill, along with Physicians for Social Responsibility, NOW, National Organization of Women. Those are three of the biggest organizations that have endorsed us, but there's a much longer list on the website. And then, if you know, there's also different groups. The Dalai Lama has endorsed this bill, along with Desmond Tutu. So we've had some individuals that I think are pretty exciting. There are actually some celebrities. We just finished doing a big campaign with Flea and Red Hot Chili Peppers, who endorsed the bill and actually promoted it during their last tour. Joaquin Phoenix, the movie star, was one of the people that's been endorsing this bill. His mother is one of our board members. So it's bringing a broad base of people. And I'm not going to lie, there are a much stronger number of progressives and liberals involved in this campaign. And that we consider is one of the best and the worst things about where our status is so far. A really strong strategy has to mean reaching out to the communities of people who are going to be most affected. And by that I'm talking about people working in or living in prisons and in institutions, the domestic violence community, the law enforcement community, and the military themselves. And I've had a lot of some interest, not a lot, but some interest in active military personnel who want to get involved in the campaign, but the U.S. government has said that they can't. And I can sort of understand this just because the Department of Defense has no position on the bill at this point. But we have had numerous former military get involved in the campaign, including people who are West Point graduates, who are really excited about how this could balance and reduce the risk to our soldiers by training, and how if we even were able to prevent one war, it would save us literally probably 20 to 30 years of a Department of Peace budget.
Do any other nations have a Department of Peace?
Costa Rica apparently is implementing it as we speak. I don't know if it's actually passed, but I know that they were doing it this month. Right now, there are no ministries or departments of peace, to my knowledge, in any other country, but we do have campaigns now going, and when I say we, I mean that there is an international, informal, non-organized, I mean, organized, but nobody's dominating it, if you know what I'm saying. So there's separate campaigns going on in a lot of countries, 17 countries, and they meet together online, and that we've had two gatherings so far, one in Canada and one in London. And the next gathering for people who are creating departments of peace within their own governments will be in September in Japan. And so, yes, there is a growing collection of people all over the world who believe that war is archaic and obsolete, that we have to find better solutions to current problems, and that we need to build the infrastructure in our governments to be able to provide those kinds of ideas and thinking and solutions to our foreign policy.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I guess the main thing is that peace is possible. And I think that we have the news media, even magazines and newspapers, for the most part, present a pretty bleak picture of what is a human being. What are we really capable of? And I think if there's anything that I want to leave people with, it's that peace is possible. And why I say that is, you know, I was a former elementary school teacher. And once you start teaching kids how to ameliorate their own conflict and teach peer mediators how to break up a fight, you'll be flabbergasted at how excited and eager young human children are in helping each other find peaceful solutions. I think as much as we can say we're a violent species, we can say that we are even more a creative and compassionate species. And through those two things, our compassion and our creativity, therein lies the hope of the world.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Lynn.
You're totally welcome. Thank you, Diane, so much for having us.
We have just been speaking with Lynn McMullen, National Campaign Director for the Peace Alliance. For more information, check on the web at www.thepeacealliance.org. Again, that's thepeacealliance.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week.